Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who writes a regular column for Truthdig every Monday. His most recent book is Wages of Rebellion: The Moral Imperative of Revolt. He will be in our region on Saturday to be part of the Money and Power Symposium, Empowering Clergy to Preach Boldly for Social Change, put on by the Capital Region Theological Center. Chris Hedges was ordained as a Presbyterian minister in 2014 and is currently ordained to write while serving at Second Presbyterian Church in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Chris Hedges back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of what message you want to get across in such a discussion about money and power.
Well, we're facing or watching a political crisis unfold around us with the destruction of the Republican Party and the rise of a proto-fascist movement built around Donald Trump, calling out, I think with some legitimacy, the duplicity on the part of a bankrupt liberal elite embodied in figures like Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, who speak in that traditional feel your pain language of liberalism but have assiduously betrayed working men and women in this country to serve corporate power. And we have undergone, as the writer John Ralston Saul has pointed out, a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, in essence a system that the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism. And by that he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. So in a classical totalitarian regime, you have a party that overthrows a decaying structure. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, but internally have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And we are watching the consequences of that with the rise of a disenfranchised, largely white class that is no longer willing to be manipulated by college-educated elites and has found in the figure of Trump a kind of proto-fascist movement that is extremely dangerous in terms of what it can do to our anemic democracy. So the church has an extremely important role. It's not one that they've played, but a role in terms of speaking out on issues of justice, speaking out against corporate power, and attempting to mobilize the disenfranchised in such a way that we can wrest back control of our society and our political system so that it serves the common good. And I think that the failure of the church to confront corporate power, and much of that is because they're dependent on corporate money, has left a kind of ideological vacuum within the country and seeded that narrative to these very frightening crypto-fascists that we see at Trump rallies.
So where does that leave the voter? Because you've condemned both of the choices currently on the ticket. So where does that leave the voter of where to look?
Well, we're not going to affect significant change until we build or rebuild mass movements. And at the turn of the century, the liberal church was deeply involved in the Chautauqua movement. Norman Thomas, the head of the Socialist Party, was a Presbyterian minister. And there was a conscious effort in the 20s and 30s on the part of industrialists to equate Christianity with capitalism and to push aside and even silence those voices within the church that were clustered around what we call the social gospel or justice movements. And I think that whether it's the anti-fracking movement, whether it's the fight for raising the minimum wage, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement. All of these movements are one that churches have to get behind. And our hope is going to come from building movements, because the political system has been completely taken hostage by corporate power and corporate money. I mean, we watch the deeply undemocratic process within the Democratic Party. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders can take 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, which he did, and Hillary Clinton gets more delegates. She has a lead in delegates, over 500 delegates who were never elected. They were just appointed. She has just benefited following Super Tuesday of the huge patronage machine put in place by the Democratic Party. And yet we see in poll after poll that in a matchup between Clinton and Trump, and Sanders and Trump, Sanders is far more likely to win. And Clinton embodies that bankrupt liberalism that has spoken in the language of inclusivity and justice and yet assiduously served corporate interests. And that's what the people rallying around Trump are reacting against. So it's a very, I think, dangerous decision on the part of the Democrats to anoint, in essence, Clinton as the candidate. We're playing now with an extremely frightening scenario. Trump has all of the characteristics of, I used to live in Latin America, the caudillo, the kind of Peronist-type demagogue, and little regard for rules, especially democratic rules. So, we're watching the kind of death throes of the American democratic state, and I think that the role of the church has an important role in terms of standing up for democracy, for the fight against bigotry, for the fight against corporate exploitation of the country, the kind of disemboweling of the country that has left city after city wastelands, upstate New York being a kind of prime example.
Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who writes a regular column for Truthdig. His most recent book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. He will be taking part in a symposium on money and power, empowering clergy to preach boldly for social change, which will be taking place on Saturday from 9 to 3 at the Radisson Hotel in Albany, put on by the Capital Region Theological Center. You can find out more information by going to crtc.org. You were ordained as a Presbyterian minister in 2014. Why was that important for you, and what do you think you can accomplish in that role?
Well, I had finished Harvard Divinity School, and in the midst of that three-year degree program, I'd taken a year off to go to Latin America. So I studied Spanish with the Marianol Fathers. And I'd always written. And I had spent my first 2.5 years in seminary living across the street from a housing project in Roxbury, the kind of poor marginal community in Boston, and grown increasingly disenchanted with liberal institutions. Not only Harvard Divinity School, where they like to talk about empowering people they never met. You know, they all liked the poor, but they didn't like the smell of the poor. But the liberal church, which had left the inner city with white flight. And I decided that going to Latin America in the early 1980s was as close as my generation was going to come to fighting fascism. And so this was the time of the dirty war in Argentina and Augusto Pinochet in Chile and Rios Montt in Guatemala and the death squads in El Salvador. And that was something that I went before the committee in Albany, and the committee was unwilling to ordain me. In the words of the head of the committee, we don't ordain journalists. And so, you know, we speak in the ministry about our call, and I certainly felt that that was my call, and if it wasn't one that the church was willing to ordain, it was one that I certainly had to follow, which I did for the next 20 years as a foreign correspondent all of that time in the developing world, and usually in places of extreme oppression, not only in the Middle East, where I was for 7 years, much of that time in places like Gaza, but in Sarajevo during the war in the former Yugoslavia. And when I came back to the United States, I began teaching in a prison, and this was something the Presbyterian Church was supportive of, but there were some people within the structures of the church who felt that I should be ordained, and so I sat down and took all five of the ordination exams, including Biblical Greek, and passed them, and then was ordained in an inner city church where many of the people who came to the ordination were members of my students who are incarcerated. And we focused the ordination service, which is on YouTube, if you type my name in ordination, mm-hmm. around mass incarceration. We brought in a blues band, and Cornel West spoke, and the great theologian James Cone delivered the sermon. So it was a deeply meaningful service, and one that validated officially the work that I do in a prison where I teach college credit courses to prisoners.
When you look at your work, has it changed dramatically as a minister?
No. My friend Stephen Kinzer, when we were at the New York Times, said, "You're not a journalist, you're just a preacher pretending to be a journalist." I was certainly driven to place myself in situations of often extreme danger because I felt that my role as a journalist, which completely dovetailed with my own understanding of faith, was to give a voice to people who without my presence would not have a voice. So I never sought, when I worked at the New York Times, I was there for 15 years, to follow around the Secretary of State or cover Washington or, in essence, be around the powerful at all. I was always in places like Iraq or Yemen or Sudan, or where people who were not only marginalized but suffering tremendously were. And so I felt that that was a use of my journalistic talents, which also buttressed my own understanding of what it means to be a Christian.
Do you still consider yourself a journalist? You are allowed to practice journalism.
Yes, in this sense. I think that the great journalists care more about truth than they care about news, and they're not the same thing. As journalists, we manipulate facts. That's what we do. And I can take one set of facts and spin a story one way or spin it another. And the very cynical journalists, of which there are many, especially on commercial airwaves, television, are quite, I think, cynical in the sense that they will allow a Republican pundit to spell out their position, however mendacious that will be, and then allow a Democratic pundit or operative to spell out their position, however mendacious that would be, and as if that's kind of balance, when that celebrity journalist probably knows that each side is manipulating or distorting the truth. And journalists whose commitment is to the truth eventually run into problems with their institutions. But I think that that commitment to the truth defines what real journalism is. And not a lot of people do it. And you can get into trouble for it. But that is always the kind of division that I made between truth and news, and I sought to convey to my readers what was true. You know, that was always my goal.
Do you feel that your former employer, the New York Times, does more of truth than news?
Well, they do a mix. I mean, you have to remember that the bulk of the New York Times is not news at all. Style and,
right,
you know, all of these sections that cater to an elite. The New York Times has targeted a demographic of 30 million Americans who are part of the 1%. That's who they target the paper for. And so their advertising and their sections cater to that kind of a lifestyle, you know, the difficulty of maintaining your second home in the Hamptons kind of stuff. And so the unwritten credo of the New York Times is do not significantly alienate those on whom we depend for power and money or access and money. And you can alienate them some of the time, but if you start alienating them a lot of the time, you're going to get pushed out. So it's, you know, I read it every day, and I there's a lot in there that's worth reading, but it is certainly an elitist publication, and it is designed to be so.
When you see a piece like they have run on Hillary Clinton and Libya, I mean, is something like that that they did over the weekend, is something like that what they do best or what they can do best?
Yeah, because they can put resources that other papers can into doing investigative journalism. I was an investigative journalist in the end based in Paris covering Al-Qaeda. And I think in that whole year I probably wrote about 5 stories. Each story took me several weeks to write, often flying to different countries to do it. That is what they do best. I mean, they still do, I think, really great investigative journalism, yes.
Why is that such a rarity? And what is it that we can do as a public, and quite frankly, even the role of the church in being able to allow people to demand more from the media?
Well, it's a rarity because at a time when newsrooms are shrinking and where, especially on the airwaves, you know, all of these networks are owned by large corporations like Viacom. So news is just one of many revenue streams in that corporation. And as a revenue stream, it has to compete against other revenue streams. So doing investigative reporting is extremely expensive and time-consuming. And most news organizations, which have stripped their staff down to almost a skeletal core, just don't have the luxury of sending off a reporter to spend weeks and weeks and weeks on what's going to turn out to be one story. So that's quite frightening. I mean, investigative journalism has become almost extinct, except for a few publications like The Times.
I want to go back to an earlier question as we wrap up, and that is in regards to what an average voter, a voter who feels in this election cycle like they don't have a place of what
we,
they can.
We got to stop thinking about voting. I mean, you know, as Emma Goldman said, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. We have to build movements. I mean, the last liberal president we had was Richard Nixon, not because he was a liberal, but because he was frightened of movements. And that's how we got OSHA and the Mine and Safety Act and the Clean Water Act. These are all these pieces of legislation that were actually written by Ralph Nader. And there's a scene in Kissinger's memoirs where the White House is surrounded by anti-war demonstrators in the early 70s, and Nixon has taken empty city buses end-to-end and put them around the White House as a barricade. And he's looking through the window going, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that's where we want people in power to be. But they're not going to be put there unless we build popular movements to keep them in check.
So we should not vote?
I vote. I voted. I was Nader's speechwriter. I vote my conscience. I vote outside the system. I don't vote for the least worst. The least worst hasn't worked out too well for us with 8 years of Obama. And I put my energy into movements. So the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, the anti-fracking movement, that when we rebuild those movements, we're going to regain political power and find a political voice.
Chris Hedges will be speaking as part of the Money and Power Symposium, Empowering Clergy to Preach Boldly for Social Change, that's being put on by the Capital Region Theological Center. The event will be held at the Radisson Hotel in Albany. You can find out more information about a Saturday symposium by going to crtc.org. crtc.org. Christopher Hedges, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much, and good to have you in town on Saturday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, you can find out more information about Chris Hedges and about the Money and Power Symposium by going to crtc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.